passenger.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, the Iridium satellites are at 300 or 400 foot altitude, 400 mile altitude, which I guess gives them a finite life. I think that's close to the altitude of the International Space Station, which needs boosting a couple of times per year. But it's got a lot more area and a lot more wind load, so to speak. Were the earlier Iridium satellites at the same altitude? Have they achieved end of life? And did I hear you say that each of the 10 Iridiums that were just launched have some kind of separate booster on each one? Or by some other means, they get them to space themselves around that particular plane of orbit. So there was a very large number of Iridium satellites launched in the past. What was their altitude? What's their current status on board, if you happen to know? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, yeah, there was, 66 of them, and I think they had some backup. And they were, as far as I know, about the same altitude. Probably 500 kilometer or so altitude. And they want to keep some of them as backups as well, especially, you know, early on when they start to shift over. I think they need more of a constellation to actually turn it on. They do test each one, and they know within, I think, 24 hours or less whether or not each and every one is working. And whether they have some fine-tuning thrusters on board, I don't know about that. Each one is released, you'll see it, and then you'll see about 30 seconds later go by, and another one will get released until they're all gone. So, and I believe they have some kind of thrusters on board, because I think 6 months down the road, they're supposed to change the altitude of some of these things, bring them up a little higher. For some reason. Back to you, Dick.
So you believe, Paul, of the original 66 Iridium satellites launched, I think a number 20 years ago, that many of them are still operational, and the new 20 satellites, or 10 satellites, are just replacing the ones in a particular orbital plane. 66 implies that there were something like 6 satellites in each of 6 orbital planes. Was that the original Iridium system? And none of them have come down? They're all still in orbit, to your knowledge, of Paul? Go ahead.
I've never heard of one deorbiting, so I don't know. But yeah, these are small, but naturally, it's many years later, so I guess the capabilities are going to be a lot better. So they really were looking forward to getting this up there. And I know that business has changed hands a couple of times, I think. I'm not even sure who's running it right now. But SpaceX has a contract for it. There were a couple of the backup satellites that were going to be launched by Russia on the Nepal rocket. They had a contract with them. I think they were going to launch 4 or 5 of them. But that contract has now gone over to SpaceX because Russia has problems with the Ukraine and manufacturing these things. They got problems, economic problems. And SpaceX wound up with a contract, I guess, who's ever doing the Iridium. Don't want to be delayed. And then they're going to have these extra ones sent up. And then there's going to be extra ones they're going to leave in the garage in case they need them in the future. And then they could launch them up as well. I think there's a total of like 80 satellites being manufactured in this, I'll call it a satellite factory. Back to you.
The Iridium system uses something that looks like a very large handy talkie. And I think it radiates on something like the S-band frequency. I presume it's being used a lot by military. I thought it originally was supposed to have commercial application, but I think it did not catch on. So the military application must be the major use even today. Is that true, Paul? K2RIW?
I understand commercially it's used quite a bit. Everybody from, cargo ships out in the middle of nowhere to maybe even people that near the North Pole. I understand these are supposed to be able to go even further north or south than the other ones. But yeah, you know, you always see those radio, the HTs, and they have this antenna sticking out of it. I'm going back a couple of years ago. Remember them saying you're going to be able to have the same type of setup, but it's going to be smaller. You won't need this. It won't have to be as big. I don't think it's going to be as small as a cell phone, but I think they're able to cut back the size of the transceivers they're going to use. Not sure about it. There's so many different constellations I'm trying to follow. There's a Galileo constellation by the European Space Agency. Japan has a whole series of them. Then you've got Net1, and they want to launch 900 satellites up. Even SpaceX wants to develop 4,000 satellites that they want to put into space. But this is very successful. This is very, you know, tried and proven, very successful, the Iridium system. Back to you.
When I'm using the handheld transceiver, which looks like a great big old-fashioned cell phone, looks like it's a pretty big bulky thing, the pictures I've seen in the past, I presume it still looks somewhat the same. Is that a little bit like a cell phone system, Paul, where the cell site is the satellite in the sky, my signal goes up to that satellite, probably gets relayed between satellites, and eventually comes back down to a ground station and gets into a landline? Is that approximately how it works, Paul, for the WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, I don't know how many gateways they have around the globe receiving these things, but yet I know they do link between each other, so they need them pretty much all the work. So, you know, you have a seamless conversation. You know, as one comes up over the horizon and then you start to lose it, the other one's going to pick you up, and then as you're talking, they'll be sending them to the other satellites. Maybe not, maybe to even another satellite in a different plane, because it's got to be able to be sent down and linked to somewhere on Earth, wherever Iridium has their nodes back there.
Paul, do you have any idea how expensive the Iridium service is? If I sign up to use one of their handy talkies, I presume there's a monthly charge as well as a charge for minutes of use. Is that the way it works? Any idea of the price?
No, I don't. But I'm sure we can find that on the internet. You know, I'm sure it's not dirt cheap, but if you're up in the middle of the Arctic someplace or out on a ship somewhere and you look for reliability, you know, that's going to be the way to go. It will be worth it. No, I don't know. And look at a place like Puerto Rico and St. John's, St. Croix. You know, I heard they was handing out satellite cell phones or satellite phones to a lot of these people. I'm sure a lot of FEMA people have them. Don't know the cost though. Back to you.
JIS.
Mr. JIS, go ahead.
K2JIS. I'm curious about whether there is a way to put a satellite or a low-orbiting helicopter or something over Puerto Rico so that you can get consistent communication for an emergency like we have now.
I think it's possible, but I don't think they're doing it. And even if you did put a helicopter over Puerto Rico, you wouldn't be able to keep it there very long. I think to give it an hour's worth of fuel to hover would be a lot. To position a satellite over Cuba is not easy. For the people in Cuba to talk with an Iridium-type satellite communicating handset, that sounds possible. The main thing the people in Cuba need, the number one thing on their priority list, I think, is water. And there is a filtration system you can buy, that's been sold by eBay for years, which will filter water. It'll filter out all of the bacteria and even the viruses. It's got a 16 micron filter. And the, to use this filtering system, it looks like a 2-liter bottle. You pour your muddy water into it and pump it up, and out comes clean water. And the 2-liter size device will make 6,000 liters of water. It takes half a penny per day to operate that thing per human being. And it gives you water in place, as opposed to trying to distribute water to all these people in these remote areas and have to do that every couple of days because they run out. I'm amazed that FEMA is not using those filtering devices. It takes a shift in thinking that they're not doing. So the people in Puerto Rico, in order to survive, they've got to have water. You can't go on water for more than 3 days. So therefore, they're quite often forced to drink contaminated water, and they're getting sick from it. So, and because distribution can't get to all the people in the difficult-to-get-to areas. So, and these are American citizens that are not being given the right amount of...
Repeater, timeout.
They're not being given the right amount of emphasis because they do not have voting rights. So, you keep the Puerto Rican people in New York City and Miami happy if you treat the people in Puerto Rico correctly, but you don't get direct voting advantage for treating the people in Puerto Rico correctly. So, our government has not treated them as well as we should be treating them, as I see it. I think that some of the answer you're looking for, Roger, getting communication there is very difficult. A lot of the cell phones are not working. Methods of charging the cell phone don't exist. The roads are in pretty bad shape. The electricity doesn't exist. But the main thing they're lacking for survival is water. Over to you for any further comments on this one, Roger. K2JAS, K2LIW.
K2JAS, thank you, Dick. You hit the nail on the head. And I think the suggestion of the filtration system is an excellent one, and it just annoys the hell out of me to try to understand the emergency preparedness thinking that has gone into this situation. The other thing has to do with, I've been listening a little bit on the bands, and I don't think I've heard very much, if any, emergency communication, such as phone patches and so on, and I was wondering if ham radio has done anything here. Back to you, K2JS.
If you go to the ARRL website, they will tell you how many amateurs are in Puerto Rico and what they're doing. And they are doing some good work. Is there enough of them? Is there enough work being done? There, I don't know. But this filtration device called Lifesaver, which I said has been sold for years on eBay, and it costs half a penny to a penny a day. And when you give somebody this device, he can be walking around the community, fixing his house, and there's lots of muddy water he has in pools and whatever. He can get water, desalinated water that was dropped by the rain. Just it's got to be purified. And to not supply, for FEMA to shift their thinking and not supply these filtering devices as opposed to shipping water, which is only a temporary solution. Very difficult to get the water to people, and any reasonable amount of water you deliver to them has to be replaced in a couple of days. You got to do it all over again. You give them that filtering device, and he's got enough water for years. So, and they make a jerry can version of it, which is good for 25,000 liters of water. That's enough water for a family of three for 4 years. We should be distributing those filtering devices to solve the filtering problem. But it takes a shift of thinking, non-traditional, and it sounds too difficult, sounds too expensive. The overall price comes out to be a half a penny per day per human being to give them potable water. Wild that we're not doing that. Now, let me ask the next question with reference to Paul on how do you find out where that satellite is? Stand by.
KC2GS.
Go ahead, Roger, you probably have some more opinions on that Lifesaver device.
Yes, CJIS. I think they should be dropping those things by helicopter. Another question had to do with do you think there should be a law that requires every gasoline station to have an emergency generator so that they can be able to pump gasoline? I think that would be a wonderful thing, but I don't know if that's even happening. And KC2GS, I think I'm going to turn it over to you,
KC2GS. KC2GS here.
Hey, go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I just wanted to relay from Rich, K2UPS. He tells me that the Iridium costs about $160 for 75 minutes for their lowest plan. I thought you would be interested in that.
Yeah, thank you. And how did Rich get that message to you? By what means, Roy? Go ahead.
Session. He saw me on Echolink, but rather than type it on Echolink, he's been emailing me in addition. So he sent it to me in his email. I get email, I get IRC chats, I get Echolink. I'm wired in here.
Are you also looking at the chat room?
Yes, I am. It's kind of quiet. I think it's just me here right now. One guy popped in, said hello, said he was having fun, and then said goodbye.
My goodness, are you connected? You're running how many computers simultaneously to do all that listening and watching and communicating? Roy, go ahead.
Well, it's not anything special. It's basically all on my desktop. I mean, I have two computers in my shack. My desktop has three monitors, so it looks a little bit like a control station. And I have my SDR and fan adapter and Echolink and all manner of things, web browsers and email. I have a second computer on the side if anything goes wonky. And I have even an iPad. So I'm firmly ensconced in the 21st century here.
My goodness, you are connected. Now, when it comes to NASA finding out where their spacecraft is, quite often it's done by the so-called Deep Space Network. The original idea was invented in the middle 60s, and the Deep Space Network consists of a number of major ground stations scattered at three different points across the world, Goldstone, California, Spain, and also Australia. These three points are roughly 120 degrees apart in longitude, so at least one of those sites is always in sight of your satellite. The Deep Space Network does ranging by sending a signal up to the satellite. The signal is received to the satellite and switched in frequency by the ratio of 240 over 221. 240 over 221. In the case of the command service module of Apollo, for instance, 221.5, let's see, 2287.5 was the uplink, 2106.4 was the downlink, and you go through the mathematics, you find out they differ by 240 over 221. Let me drop. So each of the satellites does not even require an accurate onboard frequency reference. It uses the uplink frequency as the reference to generate the downlink frequency. The uplink frequency also contains a pseudo-random code. So by looking at the pseudo-random code coming back down, comparing it to the pseudo-random code going up, you get what they call coarse ranging. I'm not sure how coarse that is, but I'm going to guess it's to the nearest couple of miles out of millions of miles because of how often that pseudo-range code repeats. After they get lockup on the pseudo-range, pseudo-random code on the uplink coming back down, they then can do phase matching. In other words, because you know the exact relationship between the uplink frequency and the downlink frequency, because one is a reference for the other, you know exactly how many cycles of RF energy you sent up. So therefore, they can eventually resolve to the nearest cycle of what comes back down, and you can get a fraction of a foot of ranging out of millions of miles. It's an amazing system. So when it comes to the slant range to your satellite, they know that with ridiculous accuracy. Let me drop. The next problem of locating your satellite is where is it in latitude and longitude? Or to use space coordinates, where is it in right ascension and declination? That's a little bit more difficult. There, the beam width of your antenna gives you a pretty strong indication of where it is. And in some cases, they use interferometry, long-range interferometry. There are periods of time in which Goldstone in Australia can see your satellite simultaneously and use both of those satellite receiving site ground stations simultaneously comparing phase, and now you can get very good cross-range tracking of what is its right ascension and declination. So it's a combination of coarse and fine ranging combined with interferometry in the downlink. So when you put it all together, in some cases you don't have to keep repeating the cross-range latitude, I mean the right ascension and declination, because once you know the velocities of cross range, and once you know the velocities of slant range, you can pretty easily predict. Let me drop. You can pretty easily predict where it's going to be for the next fraction of a year, because unless you've done a mid course correction burn, or unless there's something leaking out of something on the satellite, its trajectory is very clearly predicted because it's going through very empty space. You might worry about going near something like Pluto or its moons, and you think that it's going to be deflected. Well, that amount of deflection is very predictable. On top of that, those are very brief periods of deflection, so to speak. And a couple of measurements after that flyby lets you know exactly what it's going to be doing in the near future. So, slant range, I think they can range with ridiculous accuracy, in some cases down to feet, out of many millions of miles. But right ascension and declination, it's a little bit more coarse, but in some cases you don't need as much accuracy on that one. Does that sort of partially answer what you believe the question was, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Very good. Sometimes I'll look at the space network, and you can bring that up on your computer, the NASA Deep Space Network, and you can do all these different antennas that are working. You know, they'll have, let's say if one's talking to Juno, you'll see the, it looks like a signal leaving that antenna. Or if one's talking to Voyager, you know, you'll see that. But sometimes you'll look at, let's say, New Horizon, and you'll see Madrid Deep Space Network, and you'll see Goldstone at the same time. So when you see them going at the same time, you wonder if they're doing that. You know, that two at one time, trying to figure out where it is in declination or right ascension. I have seen that quite a bit. You know, a lot of times you'll just see one going up. Many times you'll see two at the same time. That's probably what they're doing. It's a very good thing. I thought that you could have, you know, got it down to maybe an inch or two, because of this, the frequency. Sometimes, I think a lot of it's on X-band, 8.4 gig. So why can't you get it down to, like, inches instead of feet there?
And maybe you can, Paul. There, I'm not sure. And maybe you can in theory. Now it's really another function of what is the frequency stability of your oscillator on the ground, and your oscillator that's doing the measurement. What's the frequency stability of those? Got to be a little bit of ambiguity there. Because at 8 gigahertz, boy, there's an awful lot of cycles going by each second. In the case of Goldstone and Australia looking at something like the New Horizons simultaneously, I can think of two reasons why they would use two sites simultaneously. Number one is by interferometry, getting better resolution of right ascension or declination. But another reason could be when you're using two sites simultaneously, you got twice as much receiving area. As long as you're able to properly combine the signals from the two sites in phase with each other, and because you know the geometry of the Earth and rotation and where the satellite is, you can crank out all of the phase shift because of Earth's rotation. Let me drop this. When you get the two sites listening to a satellite simultaneously, and assuming that both has the same size dish, you get twice as much receiving area. Theory, you get as much as a 3 decibel signal-to-noise ratio improvement of receiving the signal, because you're doing it two sites at once and combining it, and that gives you the ability to double the information rate. If you've got 3 dB stronger signal-to-noise ratio, instead of transmitting the data at 50 bits per second, you can transmit at 100 bits per second. In the case of New Horizons, they had a whole lot of photographs of Pluto and its moons that they had the downlink, and some of that downlink was going to take quite a few months, and some of that downlinking could be cut in half during the periods of time when you can transmit the data twice as fast. So I am guessing that is some of the reason for using two sites at once, so Paul. And when they did use two sites at once, I am guessing only one site was supplying the uplink and two sites were showing the downlink. To be simple on their diagram, they showed both giving an uplink. But I'm having trouble believing that both were giving an uplink, because that would be two signals on the receiving end beating against each other at the satellite. They're not uplink limited. They've got enough power in the uplink to give a good strong signal to the satellite. So one ground station can do it. But that downlink signal is where the limiting is, and that's why you'd like to have two signals, two ground stations listening at once. WS2N, K2LIW.
JIS.
Mr. JIS, go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. I find it kind of ironic that you can locate a satellite in space to a foot distance, yet you can't locate where all the aircraft are over the Atlantic Ocean. In particular, Malaysia Airlines MH370. You might want to discuss what is necessary to implement a GPS system such as we already have to work over the oceans using satellite relay. I think we have spent more money looking for this one plane than it would cost to have an entire system put in place. But back to you, Dick. K2JIS.
Yeah, Roger, there's another problem going on here. In the case of that Malaysian airliner, there was some speculation that it was a suicide mission and it was planned. The reason that they believe that might be true is that a number of the normal transmitters on board that aircraft got turned off. And some of them are very difficult to turn off without a lot of knowledge. So was it a major electrical failure that stopped them from emitting? Or was somebody turning them off to make it difficult to launch, to locate that satellite, to locate that aircraft? So under ordinary conditions, there are quite a few transmitters on board reporting conditions of the hardware and location. And almost all of those were turned off. The only thing that remained transmitting is something like once every hour or so, there was a transmitter on the engine that gives an engine status report. I think that's the only information they had. So because the darn many transmitters on the aircraft were turned off, that's one of the major reasons they lost locating information on that aircraft. Back to you, Roger. K2JAS, K2LIW.
And K2JAS, thank you for that comment, Dick. That was very important. I hadn't realized that. But then again, it shouldn't be too difficult to harden the system so that it cannot be turned off. So if the engines are running, the system is running, and there's nothing you can do about it. Then again, you have the Air France situation where that one went down, and it took a long time to locate where that plane was. There is a fault in the system, basic system. Planes are out of radar coverage, and they have to announce, just by voice announce where they are. They know where they are, but they're just not in communication with the air traffic system. So that should be a satellite in geostationary orbit picking up signals and relaying them. And as a private pilot, I can tell you that works very well within the range of 80 stations, K2JAS.
Yeah, thank you for that one, Roger. Rich, K2UPS, go right ahead with your information, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. K2UPS Mobile. This is just some more information for Roger. He had said he was trying to hear traffic coming out of Puerto Rico, specifically like phone patches. there's probably zero phone patch going on, and most of the information coming in and out is on digital modes for many different reasons, but they're using digital modes, I think, predominantly. And any phone calls that are being made, or when people here in the U.S. are notified that a relative is still alive, then a local ham will call that house up. But it's not a phone patch where you're going to hear people in the U.S. talking to people in Puerto Rico. I don't even know if they're taking any inbound requests yet. It's still all just outbound from Puerto Rico, the last I heard. KTUPS.
Thank you for that, Rich. What is the current mortality numbers for Puerto Rico? Is it something like 45 people have recognized as perishing? And I suspect a certain percentage of those are because of waterborne diseases. I wonder if you happen to know KTUPS, K2LIW?
That I do not know, Dick. I have not been involved myself with any of the communications. I know some people who are. But I don't know any statistics about fatality.
And the last I heard, something like 5,300 dwellings have burned down because of the range fires, the wildfires in California. Boy, that's a lot of fire. That's a lot of houses, a lot of factories and whatever. So Mother Nature is flexing her muscles these days. Okay. Let me think now. Have we run out of subjects to discuss with the space report, Paul? WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, as a part B to that question about the spacecraft, first of all, I just want to mention Santa Rosa, California is really the area that's really getting hit. And that location has a college, Santa Rosa Junior College, and they're the ones that helped out for the contact for us on Long Island for Ron Conkema when we did the school contact with the International Space Station. We got to talk to astronaut Jack Fisher, and we got the 12 children that asked questions. That was telebridged through from Long Island to Santa Rosa, California. So the International Space Station was directly above their head for that 10-minute pass. And it's a shame. I'm trying to figure out. I went on to the school website to try to figure out how the station is doing. You know, they do a lot of linking for that for the Ares project. But I haven't gotten the status yet on that. I do have a follow-up on a continuation on a question, Dick. Back to you for a second.
Okay, I'll pass it back to you in a second, Paul. Santa Rosa used to have a major installation of the Hewlett Packard Corporation. They've got a major college. They probably have a major winery. So it's quite an active area. And it looks like an awful lot of it has burned down. WS2N, go ahead, Paul. K2LIW.
Yes, the school website says that they won't be open until at least the 17th, and they think hundreds of students and faculty have lost their homes, so they got a pretty dire situation there. Second part of the question was this spacecraft, New Horizon, that's on the way to this Kuiper Belt object, it's called the 2014 MU-69. Which is probably, they're guessing, around 30 miles in diameter. It might even be a binary system. It might be 2-in-1. They suspect that from looking at the occultation with the star that was in the background recently last month from the Sophia space, Sophia 747 that was flying, that has the 8-foot diameter mirror. And they're able to look at it, and they deem the information from that, looking at the, I guess, the arc angle as it went through. It looked like it might be a binary. But the question really is, let me drop it. How do they know where that is in space relative to New Horizons? Again, declination, right ascension, or for that matter, the distance itself, you know, how is it that they're able to get so close? And they viewed us with, you know, all these planetary missions, but this one happens to be unique because this would be the first close bypass of something this far out. It's, Pluto is like 39 AU, and this thing is beyond that, probably 41 or something. Back to you, Dick.
I am guessing the location of a spatial object is done primarily by the astronomy people. They measure right ascension and declination to ridiculous accuracies of milli-arc seconds and micro-arc seconds, and they measure the range, the rate of change, the proper motion of these objects. So the astronomy people know the address of everything very well in right ascension and declination. How they get range information, there I think it's a calculation of a central force motion. If you know the rate at which the right ascension and declination is changing, and you know that the gravity field that's affecting that celestial object is the sun, and you know the sun's mass, therefore you can calculate how fast it would have to sweep in right ascension and declination in order to be at that particular range, or vice versa. Once you measure the range, once you measure the rate of change of proper motion, you can calculate what range it has to be in order to move at that rate. Anything closer to the sun must move faster. Anything further away from the sun must move slower. And a simple formula that gives you that as a ratio is that radius cubed equals period squared. As a ratio. In other words, you take the radius of an object and increase it a little bit. Take the third, take the cube of that, and then that'll give you the period of that orbit when you take the square root. So, radius.
Repeater, timeout.
So, radius cubed is proportional to period squared. That relationship for every celestial object. You could say that that was derived as one of Kepler's laws or one of Newton's laws of motion. And it's amazing that it doesn't work out to nice linear numbers. When you try to use those numbers to calculate how fast a satellite around the Earth should be moving if you change the altitude, you have to make sure you use the center of the Earth, the object that's in orbit around the Earth, thinks that all the Earth is at a dot in the center of the Earth. It doesn't know that it's really distributed, except for the mass concentrations in certain spots. You got to do some perturbation theory for that. So I think that's the step by which you know the location of a celestial object. NASA, by its navigating techniques, knows the location of its satellite. From there on, in the old days, there used to be human beings, females, who were called computers, who used to do all the handheld calculations for spatial navigation during the early Mercury Mercury and Gemini missions. They didn't have very advanced computers in those days. It was, the word computer was really a human being doing paper calculations as to where to blast the rocket engine for how long in order to do whatever you wanted to do. We've come a long way since then. So that's my best guess as to what they're doing here, Paul. Using the astronomy information combined with the NASA information in order to figure out what they're going to do next.
Repeater, timeout.
New Horizons is about to encounter an object in the... let's see now. Is it the Kuiper Belt? Yeah, I think it's about to encounter a Kuiper Belt object. What's the predicted time, date, year in which that encounter will take place, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, January 1st, 2019. So that's what I'll be doing on New Year's for that year. Paying attention to that. Okay, so basically they're using Kepler's second law. Except that they're really good at it. You know, I've seen many diagrams of that where they'll show the spacecraft or planet, doesn't matter, something in orbit around the sun, and they'll show the time it takes from, let's say, one point to another point, and they'll show the area within that location, and the amount of time that took, if that took, let's say, 10 seconds to go from there to that point, when it's going around the sun at a close point, you'll see, you know, it looks like a much bigger angle. But if you look at that shaded area of from one point to another for any exact amount of time, the shaded area is equal, you know, so it's wider, but it's shorter because it's closer to the sun in relation to the, something that was at the apex. You know, you'll look at that, it might be a thin little piece of pie, but they equal each other. So the area swept in time is exactly the same. So I guess they're using that from what you're saying there, except they probably have these things hooked up to supercomputers or something. And I haven't seen Hidden Figures yet. I've got to see that. That's the one with all the women computers. That is supposed to be a good movie. Back to you there.
Out of curiosity, is that movie still playing, Paul? Or maybe there's some way you can get it online? Is that how you intend to see it?
Well, yeah, if Optimum puts it on, I'll watch it. But if not, I'll just pick it up in the store. I mean, you can go to Walmart and buy these things for, you know, $15, $20, whatever it is. Back to you there.
Out of curiosity, Paul, how many movies have you bought at that rate by going to Walmart? Do you do that a couple times per year?
Only a very few. It has to be space-related. Last time I did it was Passengers, which was a very good movie. Very good movie. And then time before that, I don't know, I'd have to go way back. But not that often. Back to you.
JRS.
Roger, recognized. Yeah, my son and I saw Passengers in a theater. Rather well done. Very good special effects. They spent lots of megabucks on the special effects. K2JAS, go ahead, Roger. K2LIW.
K2JAS, I got a quick question. Off topic, but important anyway. Is there a way to fireproof a house like we have the problem that we're having with 1,500 or more houses burning out of California by just running a cold water pipe up to the peak of the roof and then a pipe along the edge of the peak of the roof with holes in it to bathe the house in water?
I do suspect that the embers that are falling from the nearby fire that fall onto your roof, catch your roof on fire, that if you're spraying water on your roof, you could keep your house from burning. I think that could work in a lot of cases. But now you've got a problem. How many people in the community can do that simultaneously? Can the water supply support all of that? A couple of people did have a house that was saved because somebody nearby squirted a hose on their house and put out each of the embers as it fell on the house. But this automatic sprinkling system that you just devised, I don't think the local water supply could do very many of those houses simultaneously, Roger. So if a few people did that, it could work. Assuming the water supply kept its pressure, assuming the power station is producing power, assume your local water authority had the ability to pump water. But in some cases, all of that can fail. Back to you, Roger, K2IW.
K2JAS, thank you for that opinion. That's a good question, and I am unable to answer it. The last thing I wanted to bring up is what I did with, and that's the Miller-Urey experiment with original atmospheres on the planet Earth, and whether or not the ingredients were right for creating life, and if do you know what result was from that experiment after many, 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 many years?
First of all, Miller and Urey did that experiment somewhere around 1954, as I remember. You Google Miller-Urey experiment, you'll get a lot of good information. After a couple of weeks of passing a spark through that mixture, which he thought represented the early Earth, and what he generated, that spark represented lightning, by the way, generated a primordial soup, he called it, just a brownish liquid. When he analyzed that liquid, he found 11 amino acids. The original material got put in his drawer of his desk, and some number of years later, people re-reviewed that raw material with modern-day instrumentation and found a significant number of additional amino acids. So 11 he found, and I think they found 3, 4, or 5 more amino acids later downrange. Those amino acids are the basic building blocks of life. So the Uri Miller experiment, let me drop this. The Uri Miller experiment says that when you have the right ingredients under the right conditions, life appears to be spontaneous. You can convince yourself that life will happen every time. There is a universal law of physics that says if you have enough material interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. So in the case of something as big as the Earth, 6 × 10²⁴ kilograms of stuff called Earth, that's a lot of material. The Earth being billions of years old, 4.5 billion years old, you have enough material, the right kind of material, interacting for a long period of time. So by that universal law of physics, that enough material, enough time, every reaction that's not forbidden is compulsory, and life is just early single-cellular life, which eventually develops into multicellular life and DNA and whatever, it appears to be unavoidable. It appears to be spontaneous. Could, by way of the Uri Miller experiment, come to the conclusion that under the right conditions, life will happen every time. It has no choice. Even if the life didn't form yet in this particular town, some other town a mile away, it will form. You got a lot of material and a lot of time and the right kind of material. And all those amino acids strongly suggest you're in the early steps of developing life. Those are organic molecules that you're generating. So the best analysis I know of, and again by going to Wikipedia and Uri Miller, you'll see a lot of this evidence. It's a great read, and I recommend you go there, Roger. It'll give you a lot of confidence about how life can form.
Repeater, time out.
K2JIS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roger.
K2JIS, I guess we're right up against the clock now. But yes, that's the conclusion that I come away with. Because I have looked at some of the literature recently, and they said now that they can analyze the results of the chemicals that are that they have more. I think most forms are only made out of 22 different amino acids, and they have a lot more than that now. But it doesn't mean that if you have all the right amounts of amino acids, or even the right quantity or balance or thereof, that you are going to get life. But that remains to be proved. The only ingredient that we haven't added so far is time, I guess, or sufficient time. And also they think that the original gases may have been somewhat different. Back to you, KTJS.
Net, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Yeah, we're at the bewitching hour. So, even if the material was a little bit wrong, still, when you've got all the right raw ingredients and so darn much material and something as big as the Earth, that reaction you and I call life is compulsory. All the current evidence is that life formed very early in the history of planet Earth. 73, you all. This was TechNet number 1672. That was Space Report number 272. And now that we have Dr. Roy on board, AC2GS, we get into some pretty deep science subjects and physics subjects these days. Hopefully people enjoy it. If so, let us know about that, and do send those cards and letters to Roy at TechNet, technet@ac2gs.com. technet@ac2gs.com. 73, you're all. I'm going to pass it over to Paul and Roy for any final words. WS2N, K2RI, W. Great, Paul.
Very good, Dick, and yeah, had a lot of fun tonight. Good net. A lot of traffic went back and forth. Four solid hours. Very well done, and very good with the mailbag, Roy. Good to see this thing up and running again. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, for the space portion of the TechNet.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. Thank you very much, Paul. It's been loads of fun. I look forward to doing it all over again next week, and I'll talk to you guys down the lock.
Bye-bye, Paul and Roy. Thank you. K2RI, W clear.
K2JAS, Roger. You still there? K2UPS.
K2UPS, K2JAS. Yes, I am. And, unfortunately, I will not be here for the next 6 months. I'm going down to Florida, but I'm up here in central Jersey. Back to you.
You could talk to us on Echolink. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Hey, Roger, just want to let you, I don't know if you knew what, there was a bunch of people that had tried putting their sprinklers, tying lawn sprinklers up on the roof of their houses, but there's a product that I saw a number of years ago. I don't know how expensive it is, but they take the crystals that are in disposable diapers, and it's the same crystals that they also mix in potting soil so that you don't have to water your plants as frequently. They mix it with water and spray this, it's almost like a clear jelly, onto the home that might be affected by a wildfire, and it's been very successful in protecting it, because then as the fire comes up, most of those wildfires pass through pretty quickly. They're very hot, but they're very fast moving, and the water that this gel has absorbed gives itself up in evaporation as it absorbs the heat, and it's a very successful product. I just don't know how widespread it is or how expensive it is.
Yes, Rich, that is a fascinating idea. Thank you for that. That product wouldn't be vermiculite, would it?
No, it's not vermiculite. It's 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you. tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you.